I'd like to call to order the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. The time is 8 a.m., February 8th. And present, we have Representative Osterman, Representative Gardner, Representative Foster, and myself, Chair Munoz. This morning, we have two items on the agenda. We have an informational overview from the City of Unalaska regarding their ongoing pollutant discharge permit with DEC and the EPA. The situation involves new EPA regulations and standards required of Unalaska. It's an issue that has wide-spreading ramifications affecting many communities throughout Alaska, and that is why we are hearing the issue in the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. Today we have Chris Ledick here from Unalaska, the city manager with Unalaska. Chris, if you'd like to come forward and make a presentation, and then we'll turn it over to the committee for questions. And then at the end of the report on this issue, we'll move into a discussion on HB 130, residential sprinkler systems. So welcome and thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Ladek, for the record, and I'm the city manager for Unalaska. And I've been there since 2001. And so I'll just give you a brief overview to cut a long story short. In 1999, a new wastewater treatment plant came online for approximately $3.5 million. In 2004, we reapplied for a new permit, and in the permit were technical limits such that it required us to go from primary to advanced primary treatment. Also, I need to talk about the two other projects that are sort of directly involved in what we have to do by 2014. And one is the landfill. And the landfill project, we need to build a new cell. The landfill is a lined landfill, and the leachate goes into the wastewater collection system. That leachate impacts our ability to treat wastewater via the stuff that's in the leachate. Precipitates on the ultraviolet bulbs and really affects the efficiency of the plant. After the wastewater treatment project was built, the landfill leachate was put into that waste stream. So in 2004, we got new technical limits. We realized that we're primary treatment. This looks like advanced primary treatment. We went back to EPA. And with the help of DEC, convinced EPA that a mistake was made on the permit. They drafted an amendment to the permit and put it out to public comment. When that permit went out to public comment, the Fish and Wildlife Service basically stomped on the permit and said, you didn't do a Section 7 consultation with us on the impacts of the outfall on the Steller Zider. EPA threw their hands up and said, we don't have time for this, and they basically turned it over to enforcement. Enforcement came along and said, well, you've been in violation since 2004, and Dan is here. I don't think in the 2004 permit there was a timeline to build a new plant. That was never included, so it's like a switch went off in 2004, and we have been in violation of that current permit since this time. So when it was turned over to enforcement, we negotiated with EPA on what to do. We didn't come to a conclusion on that. They turned it over to the Department of Justice, and now we are dealing with attorneys in Washington, D.C., and settlement negotiations, and basically how much is the fine and when is the plant going to get built. So we are in a position where in 1979 there were 76 villages that were on a list. Unalaska was one of them. We're a town of about 3,500 people now, and we've basically somehow, the policy's been changed, and we are right now going to advanced primary and possibly to secondary treatment. The cost for a new plant right now for advanced primary would be $11 million. If we have to go to secondary treatment, it would be $24 million. And the difference in operating cost is going to be huge because you have to deal with sludge. Sludge is going to have to go back to the landfill where leachate will go back to the wastewater treatment plant. And I've told this story now, I think Dan and I were talking to three different commissioners now. And Dan and his crew, Lynn Kent and DEC, have been aware of what's going on. They've been trying to help, and I have to let him talk to you about the DEC side of things. But where we are today is I got to build a new landfill cell for $9 million. There's also a little thing called the LT2. It's a water plant requirements by EPA, which we have to be online by 2014 to deal with a cryptosporidium, which we found basically two oocysts in a billion parts of water. There is no maximum contaminant level for been created by EPA, so if you find it, you got to build a plant. That's $9.5 million, and I'm looking at $11 million minimum on the wastewater treatment plant. And the costs for just on a sewer side are we've increased our bills by 83%. And if we go to advanced primary, we're probably going to be around $120 a month. And if we go to secondary, it'd be well over $150 a month. So with that, I'll just kind of, that happy tale.
Thank you. Thank you. Please let the record show that Representative Sadler has joined us. And also in the audience, Representative Herron. Representative Herron, would you like to join us at the table? Thank you. Are there questions, Representative Osterman?
On a number of occasions, your ex-mayor has indicated how well off or how well Unalaska does as the number one seafood port in the nation compared to Kodiak. So what are you waiting for? Why don't you just do it?
The amount of money that's involved is tremendous. And plus the cost of the rate shock to the consumer. And we are doing it. I mean, we are in planning phases for all three of those projects. We are, the design is done on the water plant. We've applied for water money through DEC, and we'll be applying in Washington, D.C., for monies for the water and the wastewater. There's no money available for landfills, and we'll probably be borrowing money for that.
Yes, continue.
So do you have a dollar figure for the state of Alaska involvement in this project or these projects, depending on how much you're expecting from the federal side?
Right. I'm applying for $3 million for the water treatment plant, and I'll be applying for the same amount of money from the feds, and we're asking for $4 million for the wastewater, and we'll be asking for $4 million from the feds, and the rest will come for us. And if we have to go to secondary treatment, I don't know how long that's going to take to get the financing together for that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Have you had the opportunity to talk with our federal delegates about this problem, and do you think there's anything they could do to be helpful?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, yes, we have had many discussions, and hopefully there will be committee hearings in Washington, D.C. on this issue as well, and we will be working with DEC on a possible legislative fix in Washington.
Thank you.
Good. I have a question. There are approximately 76 communities that were exempted in 1979 from the Clean Water Act requirements for primary or secondary processing. What is it that goes into play with these communities as examples that would require a more thorough processing, either advanced primary or secondary, with their existing permits? In other words, what kicks into place the need for a more advanced processing, if you will, from what's currently being done in these 76 communities? Is it a periodic renewal of the permit, or?
I believe it's every 5 years the permits come up, and when EPA and DEC look at it, I've never seen a permit have less restrictions in it. So every time you have a permit renewal, there's usually something that's changed. But to answer your question, I don't know what the process will be for deciding what's next for the rest of the communities, because I don't know what happened, why we're where we're at, given the fact that there was in the Federal Register published policy by EPA, and that appears to have changed without any of that.
Okay. In Alaska, DEC has primacy over these issues. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. We may want to get somebody from DEC here to testify. We have Lynn Kent, Director of the Water Division, as well as Dan Easton, Deputy Commissioner. Are there additional questions?
Yes. Chair, sir, when we got primacy over point discharge, was EPA generally cooperative? What's their general attitude been toward the whole process of letting Alaska take the lead in the MPDES?
I think that's a question for Mr. Easton. We have dealt with both DEC. I guess primacy happened in between this going on, and as far as I know, EPA is still handling like our case. We would very much like to see DEC completely take over enforcement and everything of this, so we could just deal with the folks that we know and that know our community.
Thank you. And let the record show that we did invite EPA to the table to speak to us today, and they declined our offer. Are there additional questions? Okay. Is Dan Easton with DEC in the audience? Yes. Hi, Mr. Easton.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Dan Easton. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. If you'd like, Madam Chair, I can maybe supplement some of the story as Chris told it. And I can tell you that, you know, my involvement with this is not secondhand. It started in 2004. And I got a call from a relatively new city manager in Onalaska, a guy I'd known from Dillingham, where he had been city manager there. I knew him to be a straight-shooting guy. He called and said, Dan, we've got a new permit, and something's changed. There's something wrong, and we're going to have trouble meeting this permit. And he asked that we take a look at the permit and see if we could see what was going on. So I worked with our staff at DEC. We took a hard look at that permit, and there was a mistake in it. It was an error. And it was actually an error of our making, and DEC made it. It was an EPA permit, but we certified the permit when we did some calculations for the certification. We made a mistake. We went to EPA and said, EPA, we've made a mistake. This permit is wrong. The city's not going to be able to comply with it as a result of this mistake. Can we fix it? And EPA said, sure, we can fix that permit. They prepared a modification that would have corrected the errors, but that modification was never made. So since that was 2004, and since 2004, the city, for that reason and other reasons, you heard Mr. Laddick talk about the fact that they have some treatment issues that have to do with running their landfill leachate through this wastewater treatment plant. So for that reason and a couple of reasons, the city has had trouble complying with the permit. And as Mr. Laddick indicated, a few years ago, EPA said, we've got a problem, you're violating your permit, this is going to be an enforcement action. And in fact, the city and EPA came very close to negotiating a settlement to that. And the settlement included a compliance period. So the city would have agreed, yes, we violated the permit, but we're willing to make some changes, upgrades to the treatment plant. I'm sorry.
Mr. Easton, if you could speak more into the microphone, please. Thank you.
I wish I could. I could. And I'm still trying to overcome my Juno disease here, so I will do the best I can. Let's see, where was I? So There was a modification. There was an enforcement action. It was nearly settled. It included a compliance schedule, would have given the city some time to make upgrades to their sewage treatment plant. Unfortunately, at the last minute, that settlement offer was revoked by EPA, and that wasn't settled. And then sometime in the last few years, EPA actually took it a step further, referred the case to the U.S. Department of Justice. So it's the EPA federal permit enforced by a federal agency with the help of the U.S. Department of Justice now. So I think it's a matter of record. The negotiations between the city and the Department of Justice are confidential, and we know some of those negotiations, and some of it is less confidential because it's in the form of written correspondence with the city. And I can tell you that I have read in that correspondence that what the Department of Justice has said is, said, look, we'll reduce the amount of fine if you'll provide a higher level of treatment, secondary treatment, than you're required to under your waiver. So to get to step back for just a second and explain, every city has to provide secondary treatment of their sewage unless there's a waiver. And in Alaska, there are several forms of waivers. This city of Unalaska has one form, like 75 other cities, a waiver. And with that waiver, they can produce, they can treat a primary, a lesser level of treatment. So what the Department of Justice has offered to the city is, look, we'll reduce the fine if you'll go ahead and provide secondary treatment as if you didn't have a waiver, a very expensive proposition. So recently, it seems to us that the pace of negotiations between DOJ and the city have slowed, if not stopped. But that's kind of where the situation sits. So that's the story. I think it's very consistent with the way Mr. Laddick provided it. I can tell you that we have made every offer to intervene on behalf of the city. We're not satisfied with EPA's approach. It wouldn't be our approach simply because it's not the fastest way to achieve compliance. We have offered to intervene in every way. We would, I think, in our preference, we would simply have this whole case, the permit, the enforcement case, referred to DEC. We'd be willing to make promises in terms of working with the city to extract an agreement, to improve treatment, to achieve compliance in a time certain. We've made those offers. They've been rebuffed by EPA. I can tell you also that I've dealt with the city of Unalaska for a lot of years, and I've always found them to be most responsive. We've worked through a contaminated site issue involving PCBs. We developed landfill improvements. We worked through a power plant air permitting issue. We've never had an issue with the city, and we're confident that if we could intervene, that we could work with the city to come to some sort of reasonable resolution. Madam Chair, there's one other item that was brought up previously that maybe I can clarify. On primacy, these 76 waivers, the communities that have these 76 waivers, like on Alaska, they would transfer to DEC. We will write those permits. We'll be responsible for enforcing those permits. The reason that Unalaska didn't transfer is because there's a provision in the transfer agreement that says that in the event that EPA has an ongoing enforcement case, that the permits in the cases stay with EPA until resolved. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason that Unalaska didn't transfer, whereas the other permits either have or will. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'll leave it at that.
So in following that, the other communities are not necessarily subject to or potentially subject to the same issues that Unalaska is because of the primacy issue?
Exactly, Madam Chair. And I don't want to downplay and say that there's no threat that another one of these communities would find themselves in this situation. But there are There are circumstances that make this situation a bit unique to Onalaska. So it's not that it couldn't happen. It's just that I don't know that it's a foregone conclusion that because it's happening in Onalaska that every other community would, on this list of 76, would face the similar circumstances.
Okay. And Representative Heron has a question, and then we'll go to Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Of course, I've known the commissioner for a long time, and when I was city manager, we were closely together. But just to say, he's always soft-spoken. So, but I guess that is the. Of course, I wish Chris and his community was not the poster child for the EPA, and the sequence of events that happened. But I guess that the Madam Chair's question is right to the point. We may be in first position right now on those other communities, but unfortunately, in my opinion, considering what I had to deal with when I was a city manager, is it wouldn't take much for EPA to come stomping on Bethel or any other community because of a mistake. For example, in the city of Bethel, as I worked with Mr. Easton very closely, when Senator Stevens had a huge revenue stream into the state for Village Safe Water, and of course the avenue has changed a little bit. There's still money coming in, but the community decided, like Chris's community is going to have a rate jolt, is that the community that I live in changed their mind and decided not to put in a sludge plant. So a sludge plant in 2004 cost $10 million. What's it going to cost in 2014 when EPA requires the city of Bethel? So I think that the issue is extremely serious, and Chris has been talking about this for 5 years, not on deaf ears, but this sort of, how can we take on EPA? How can we challenge them? And so it's a huge, huge, broad issue that the state of Alaska is probably going to, unfortunately, is probably going to be stuck with a huge bill spread over 76 communities.
Thank you. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I think you answered my question, but let me just make sure. I was going to ask you if there's any precedent for the state taking over in a situation like this where there's a dispute with the EPA. And if I understand correctly, you said that Onalaska was the only one in that particular situation, the other 75 communities you've been able to take over. So do you know if there's any precedent anywhere else in the nation where the local enforcement and environmental conservation agency has been able to take over where there's an ongoing case?
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, it's a wonderful question. I wish I could answer it. I don't know. The situation is really peculiar. The Onalaska permit didn't transfer because we're in a transition period. So it's just an unusual set of circumstances. So is there a precedent for it? I mean, there is generally. I mean, generally the EPA would, in the case of primacy, defer to the state. It doesn't mean that they don't retain a right to objection or basically oversight authority over the state. But so generally, yes, you know, it's the norm that the EPA would defer to the state, but it's just because of the unique circumstances here. Again, we're in the middle of this transition to primacy. There's this provision in that agreement that says that until resolved, this any ongoing enforcement actions remain with EPA. So I don't know that it's even come up before, let alone whether there's a precedent. But mm-hmm. I hope that answers your question.
It does, but I'm not happy about it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And let the record know that we've been joined by Representative Cisna. Thank you. Representative Osterman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dan, so I have a better understanding of secondary versus primary. In Kodiak, we have what, secondary treatments plants?
Madam Chair, Representative Osterman, I believe that you have primary.
Primary?
And Kodiak, Lynn Ken is, I think, listening in, and she may be able to. In fact, let me, if I could just check a note here, maybe I can.
Lynn, are you online?
Yes, I am, Madam Chair.
Did you hear the question regarding Kodiak and whether it's primary or secondary?
I think it's.
Madam Chair, I don't know for sure, but I would presume that Kodiak is on secondary, and while we're speaking, I will see if I can look that up for you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I've been able to confirm that. Kodiak does provide secondary treatment.
Just to follow up on that, and it is an expensive major operation. It costs a lot of money to maintain and operate, and sludge is an issue of where you dump it and take care of it in the landfill. It's something we're constantly dealing with down there.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Reese, you described the story about how there was a mistake in the calculations in the permit that Unalaska did. Was that a substantive error in calculations that actually affects the, I don't know, capacity of the treatment plant, or was it a minor technical thing that it just kind of?
Madam Chair, Representative Sadler, it was a very substantive mistake. It is of the nature of it. There are probably three primary limits in a permit. One deals with total suspended solids. One deals with biochemical oxygen demand. Maybe those two are the most important. The other would deal with fecal coliform bacteria, and it was a reversal. The permit should have said that the city is required to remove 30% of the BOD, biochemical oxygen demand, and or total suspended solids, and the permit inverted those numbers and reflected 70% removal. So where it was supposed to be 30% removal, by the Clean Water Act definition of what's primary treatment, it instead required 70% removal. It was a very substantive error. Now, had that permit been corrected, would the city have would not had any violations? No, there would have still been violations. They're primarily fecal coliform, and it's a result of impacts of leachate on the treatment process. But had the permit been corrected, it would have resulted in a much fewer instances of permit violations.
And a follow-up, if I could.
Yes.
Mr. Has EPA acknowledged that they had some complicity in not resolving this error, that they said they would fix it and then did not do it? Are they confident in that at all?
Madam Chair, Representative Sadler, they have. They acknowledged it. They prepared a modification to the permit to correct the error, and for reasons that I don't understand, they never went ahead with that modification.
Time to talk to the attorneys.
I think the city has one.
Okay. Are there additional questions? Also online is Cameron Leonard from the Attorney General's Office. Are there questions for Mr. Leonard or Ms. Kent? No. Okay. Yes, you do. We have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Well, speaking of the attorneys, this is great. I guess I'd ask Mr. Leonard, Cameron, Mr. Miss, what the prospects are of settling this issue with the EPA and any kind of favorable conditions to the city and the state.
Yes, through the chair, this is Cameron Leonard. I'm an assistant attorney general with the state, and I've been involved in some of the settlement discussions. They've been dragging on for a number of months now. I wouldn't want to seem overly pessimistic, but at this point, I don't hold out a lot of hope that the settlement discussions are going to bear fruit. The EPA and DOJ seem a long ways apart from the city of Unalaska right now in terms of settlement, but the discussion is still going on, so there's still some hope there.
Mr. Leonard, recently in the hearing today, it was alluded that the city of Unalaska is working with the congressional delegation on a legislative fix. Do you know what that might be?
No, I'm not familiar with what kind of legislative. I can imagine legislative fixes that would address the problem that they're facing, but I don't know anything about the discussions that have actually taken place on that.
Okay. All right, thank you. Are there additional questions? Yes, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. This is really interesting, and it's new to me, but I guess, are you here simply to make us aware of the issue, or is there something in particular that you'd like this body to, some action you'd like us to take?
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, I'm here because I was asked to be here, and I'm darn glad to be here.
Thank you. Perhaps my question's for the city of Onalaska, then.
Sure. Would you like... Thank you, Mr. Easton. Easton?
Yeah.
Easton, Mr. Easton, thank you very much.
Yeah, through the chair.
And if you could state your name again for the record.
Chris Laddick, city manager for Onalaska, through the chair, Representative Gardner. We're here today to let everyone know that this is going on and we're seeking funding for it, and that these other communities should be aware of what's going on and what the possible ramifications are for Bethel, Kotzebue, Nome. I know Barrow's already gone to secondary treatment, but they're huge. It's already very expensive to live in Onalaska, and we're talking about going from $50 a month to over $125 a month just for your sewer bill, not to mention the fact that your water bill is going to go up because we have to build, and we have some of the cleanest water in the state of Alaska, and we're building a $9.5 million plant. And then your landfill bill is going to go up. So from a management perspective, we're taking all these funding away from, we should be providing the infrastructure for the fishing industry to continue to grow. And those funds are getting diverted to meet EPA regulations.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Heron and then Cisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess to Representative Gardner, to reinforce the message that Chris is bringing again, because his community is the poster child of this, is that it's the issue facing many of my communities is essentially, it's a nice word, primary means essentially an open lagoon, and it's aerated with no mechanical devices. And so, and then there's then you discharge the water into the environment, you know, the water that's clean, and it's tested. It's when you go to anything beyond primary, that means a mechanical system, and in some communities, I don't care what you put in there, you can't afford it. And so, to have a sludge plant that costs $10 million today in 5 years is going to cost twice as much. And so that's my fear, is EPA is going to decide. The reason they're in it is because Fish and Wildlife came barging through the door and says, well, we're not going to allow EPA to approve that modification because it affects us, the eiders. So what's going to happen in my community is when EPA says, okay, we're not going to allow you to discharge into the Kuskokwim River until you put a sludge plant in. What are you going to do in the meantime? Is everybody going to have to, what are they going to do with their sewage? Hold it in tanks on their own private property because they won't allow it to go into the lagoon? I think that this is what's facing the legislature, is we're going to be stuck with a very, very large bill to have safe water, and that's a good thing. But under, you know, what are you going to do in the meantime? And it really is about the end user, the ratepayer. How much can they afford? Can I afford a $250 a month sewage bill in Bethel, let alone the $250 you pay for water?
Thank you, Representative Heron. Representative Cisna. And please, before you start, if the record could show that Representative Dick has joined us. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and hello. I'm wondering, and I came late, and I do apologize for that. So there's much I've missed here in this issue, but I'm wondering if the size of the industry in your community compared to the small has sort of captured attention where other places might not capture the attention. Is that possible?
Through the chair, Representative Cisna, I believe that is possible, but we still are a town of 3,500. I think Bethel's a town of 7,000, so I think, what was a village in 1979 may have changed for all of us.
Please continue.
And the real question for me is what part does the industry that's spread out over quite a bit of space through different waterways, does the issue involve any of the water use in those areas, or is it just solely in the heart of the community itself, the town area?
Through the chair, Representative Sisnev, the industry is hooked up into our wastewater treatment system, and they obviously pay for wastewater services that we provide.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a real eye-opener for me, and I appreciate not only you're bringing this forward. I have 13 communities that's on this list here, and I would hate to see, the folks in a community where, the average income is maybe at the poverty line, and then on top of that you're adding, extra costs, and you're fighting with the issue of high energy costs. And I appreciate the input that Representative Heron gave. That history, I think, is really important in knowing what those impacts are. But I appreciate that, and certainly if there are things that, our office can do to be involved, we want to make sure that we're not going to be in a position where we're sitting where you are later, somebody from, my district. So thank you for that.
Thank you. You spoke earlier about a congressional fix that you were working on through the delegation. Could you speak to that and how that might affect this situation in Unalaska?
It's not going to affect the situation in Unalaska as far as having to go to advanced primary treatment, but it might be something that DEC would want to look at or work with us on for all the 76 villages to add another layer of protection. To put something actually in the regulations about, keeping them from going to secondary treatment.
Okay. Representative Sisna, did you have a follow-up?
No, I did not.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Also here today we have Mark Lynch, the city manager from Cordova.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate this opportunity to speak briefly. I am Mark Lynch, the city manager in Cordova, Alaska. I would like to say that Cordova is not on the list, and so we also have a problem. Our problem is twofold. Number one, I began in Cordova as city manager in September of 2009. On December 30th, I received a phone call from a lady at DEC letting me know, for my first time at least, that we were required to have secondary treatment on our water supply. I know that's not what we're here specifically to talk about, but it all plays into the same situation, I think, that we're talking about here today. Initially, our estimates in Cordova for the work that they asked us to do to our water treatment facility was estimated to be in the $5 to $10 million range, and most recently our engineering firm CH2M Hill has informed me that it's most likely will be at the $10 million range and possibly even higher now as they look more closely at the system. More recently, just within the last a couple of months, I became aware of the situation with our wastewater treatment plant. Our permit had expired approximately 4 years ago, and we had been in the process of trying to get that permit renewed, and a few months back, for whatever reason, I'm not sure, but the DEC decided to go ahead and work on that permit, and some folks came and did a review of our records and looked over the wastewater treatment plant and informed us that we had been in violation, I believe it was 145 times. Basically our initial estimates on that just for the Well, I should back up. The primary reason that I can determine, and again, I'm fairly new there, and so is our Director of Public Works, but in the mid-2000s, our parts per million that were allowed to discharge was reduced from 50,000 to 10,000. We have actually some question about whether, in our case, there could have possibly been an error in the calculations for our mixing zone, which is the area that the effluent mixes into as it's discharged. And I've actually asked CH2M Hill to verify the calculations in the event that there was an error without knowing about the error that was spoken of here today. But regardless of the outcome of that, we're talking about a cost to Cordova. And I want to just take my few minutes that maybe remain and talk about what I want to call common sense and the impact on the citizens. EPA passed a legislation on the LT2 legislation, which you heard Mr. Laddick speak of earlier, has to do with our drinking water and a little bug called Cryptosporidium. They passed that essentially in a blanket policy nationwide without any consideration to community. And our community, quite frankly, does not have Cryptosporidium. Because of the way our water source works, it's very unlikely we would ever have it. We've already had, we've spoken with our local health nurse and our hospital. They have no record on file of us ever having an illness caused by Cryptosporidium. And yet we're told that we're to spend $10 million to put in a new water treatment plant to treat for something we don't have. That's a cost to our population, our residents, in our case, of about $120 a month, possibly $150, early calculations, for just the water part. Now along comes wastewater treatment. We're talking about not only the violations that they've identified with our primary treatment, but I believe because we're not on that list, we're probably in line to be told that we need to have secondary treatment, which we currently don't have. And the engineers are telling us that will be probably another $10 million. We're now looking at $250 to $300 a month to our citizens for water and sewer treatment. Because we only have 2,000 residents, about 700 households, and the cost of this has to be borne by them. And I'm also finding as we move through this process that there are really no or very few grants available. Most of this is done through low-interest loans, and so it means that the entire cost of this would be borne by the citizenry. So the common sense of the matter is we don't need the water treatment part of it especially. I'm not as up to date. You've heard Mr. Laddick and talk about the wastewater side. I'm not as familiar with the wastewater side, but I know that we're looking at both in the community of Cordova, and our citizens just simply cannot afford this sort of cost to be placed on them. And again, the point was made, this is money that could be used for economic development. We have a hospital that needs a roof. We just finished a school renovation because it had health standards. We're concerned about our citizens, but we want to put the money where it needs to be, not because there's some blanket policy that we have to comply with the same thing that Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or Dallas, Texas has to comply with. So that's all I have to say. If you have questions, otherwise, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you for coming today. Are there questions? Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay. All right. Well, I think we have accommodated everybody on the schedule that was signed up to testify or that was available for questions. Are there additional comments or thoughts? Yes, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm reading through the material we've been given. I think it's fair to say that while the EPA was invited to participate in this hearing, they responded. They didn't just ignore the response and said that they're involved in confidential negotiations, so they couldn't speak. So I just wanted the audience to know that.
Representative Cisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The thing that's interesting to me is that having lived in Kodiak and remembering very well that there was a lot of expense and a lot of conversation between EPA and the local people sometimes some real questions about how things were being done. And both the Department of Environmental Conservation and Community and Regional Affairs probably has a history of this with probably working at the different communities in Alaska and the different challenges and different costs. And the cost factor all by itself has got to be a huge part of this, but I'd love to be able to understand it better. Just thinking of the fact that when you're off the road system and you're trying to deal with, unfortunately, Washington, D.C., and their distance, and they're not understanding what's going on in Alaska, but at the very same time, the real incredible need that we have to pay attention to safe water and to be able to do the right job, but still be able to afford it and have people working with us. Just wondering what the Commerce, Community, and Economic Development has, what their history is, and look also at environmental conservation and try to get a handle on what we're really talking about when we look at the whole state and this community's situation here. Is that possible? Is there somebody who we could call on that would know?
To clarify, you're asking to excuse me, to look at the potential impacts on all of the 76 communities? Is that
well, and really getting a good understanding of what our responsibilities are as well. Because we do lead the nation. We're somewhere in the 70 percentile on safe water for our communities, and the rest of the United States is in 99%. So we're trying to catch up on being safe communities and providing healthy environments for our communities. But at the same time, the costs are mammoth. And so there's a responsibility, yes. At the same time, we're operating in a very different world than other parts of the United States. So I'd love to know, and we've been going through this. This is something that there's a long history in Alaska. I'd love to have some background understanding.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Sisson. Yes, Representative Dick.
Yes, and I have a question that I don't expect anybody to have an answer for, but I wonder if we have these two communities that have testified to us, I wonder how many other communities have concerns and just haven't been able to get to Juneau or get our attention.
Mm-hmm.
If these, you know, seem to be extreme examples, but I wonder how many other small communities out there have similar concerns that you just they haven't been able to get to us here in Juneau.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. Are there additional thoughts or comments before we continue? Thank you. Well, I would like to work on a draft letter from this committee and possibly a resolution, but I want the input of all of you in doing that, a letter that would go to the EPA and possibly to our delegation as well. And certainly we'll call on the communities that testified today to help us with that. All right? Thank you. And before we go on, we're moving on to HB 130, Residential Sprinkler Systems. I'd like to take a short break. Thank you. So back to order, the Community and Regional Affairs Committee, and we are now discussing HB 130, Residential Sprinkler Systems. And who is here to present the bill today? Rob Earle, would you like to step forward, please?
For the record, Rob Earle, staff to Representative Herron. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your consideration. The main point behind HB 130 is that if a municipality wants to consider mandating fire sprinklers in all new construction, the ordinance must first go through an expanded public process. The parties interested in this legislation mostly fall into two groups, the Alaska State Home Builders Association and the Alaska Association of Realtors on the one side, are concerned about a blanket mandate for sprinklers that would raise the cost of homes considerably. And on the other side, the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association, who for obvious reasons promote expanded installation of fire sprinklers. Madam Chair, as you recall, last year the Community and Regional Affairs Committee did some heavy lifting on similar legislation, and that committee was instrumental in facilitating a compromise between those two groups, and that compromise, Madam Chair, is the legislation before you today. We know of no opposition. This bill is neither pro nor anti-fire sprinkler. The legislation does not prohibit Alaskans from choosing to install these systems. The legislation says that a municipality may not adopt an ordinance to require a sprinkler system in all new residential buildings with one or two dwelling units unless the municipality first do three things: comply with the municipal ordinance requirements already in statute, at least 30 days before the first public hearing for the ordinance, publish a summary of the ordinance and a notice of the time and place of each public hearing, and schedule at least three public hearings to be held within a 60 to 180 day period on the proposed ordinance. Madam Chair, the sponsor does believe the decision about sprinkler systems being required in homes is appropriate to be decided at the local level. The question is, does such a potentially expensive code revision, such as installing, as requiring the installation of sprinkler systems, deserve a more robust public hearing process? And we think it does. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. And what I'd like to do now is I'd like to go to the individuals that are signed up for public testimony, and then, Rob, if you can come back at the end of the meeting. Some of our members have to leave by 9:30, so I just want to give them an opportunity to testify. Okay. All right. First up is Jeff Tucker, president of AFCA.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Tucker. I'm the president of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. I want to thank Representative Herron and his staff for the work they did on this bill, and quite simply, the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association does not oppose HB 130 as it's currently drafted.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. And Paul Michelson. And I might note that Paul brought in donuts today.
Actually, for the record, Wendy brought them to pay for somebody else. I carried them in because she's in a little bit of a dilemma there, but thank you for the acknowledgement.
All right, thank you.
And I'll bring them tomorrow if it clears the air. My name is Paul Michelson. Last name is spelled M-I-C-H-E-L-S-O-H-N. I represent the Alaska State Home Builders Association. We are in support of HB 130, Madam Chair and fellow members of the committee. It's something that we've been working with for approximately 2 years. We feel that we've all come to the Fire Coalition and ourselves have come to an agreement that is workable in the industry. I think this bill will let the jurisdictions, each individual jurisdiction, get the notice out to their people and give the overall body of the jurisdiction the time to weigh in and decide how they want to approach it in the future. We ask that you pass this bill. We beg that you pass this bill out and move it on, and we are in 100% support, and I'm here for any questions that come up related to this. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And next up is Errol Champion with the Alaska Realtors.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I apologize. It was my phone that went off. I have a Bluetooth arrangement that goes into my hearing aids. I didn't think you could hear it because I barely could. So in any event, my apologies. I know the protocol. I'm speaking on behalf of the Alaska Board of Realtors. We've been here before you last year on this matter. We thought we had assurances that it would be adopted, but it didn't make it, so we're back again this year. I'm not going to take a lot of time. The reasons that we spoke in support of the bill are still valid. We need to keep the cost of acquiring homes in Alaska as inexpensive as possible, and this bill will go a long way to helping it. So I urge your adoption of it, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. And Wally Smith with the Alaska State Home Builders Association.
Yes, ma'am. I'm Wally Smith, a member of the Alaska State Home Builders Association, and also from Fairbanks, and I'm a member of the Interior Alaska Building Association. I would just like to echo Paul Michelson's statements from the interior. We certainly support, you know, this legislation, and he did an adequate job of, you know, explaining our position, and I'd just like to echo that. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And next up is Daryl Bourne with the Alaska State Home Builders Association.
Thank you. My name is Daryl Bourne. I'm the president of the Interior Alaska State Home Builders, or the Interior Alaska Builders Association in ASHPA, a member of ASHPA, and I support this bill and agree with Wally and Paul Mickelson, and I'd like to see it move through.
Thank you. Next up is Alan Wilson with the Alaska State Home Builders Association.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alan Wilson. I'm a local builder, member of Alaska State Home Builders, co-chair with Michelson of the Legislative Committee. Obviously, we've had a lot of discussion about fire sprinklers in the past, so I'll be really brief. You know, I personally have, I'm supporting the bill and have some dire concerns about the cost of housing, not only in Juneau, but across the state. And I think the bill gives each municipality to kind of predict their own future, their own destiny. And since it is such a significant change from what we've been doing, I think having the mandatory three public hearings is quite critical, because things do happen fast and people, public members, don't always pay attention to those public notices. So they tend to miss meetings and whatnot. So certainly support passage of the bill. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for being here. Thank you. And then let's, I think that is, no, okay. That's everybody that is signed up here in the room today, but on the line we have Glenda Feakin with the Alaska Association of Realtors. Glenda?
Good morning. This is Glenda Feakin from Kenai, Alaska. I'm with the Alaska Association of Realtors, and we strongly support HB 130. Realtors encourage affordable housing. This will cause a dramatic increase in construction, maintenance, resale, and insurance. So we believe that people affected by this should be advised of the incredible burden that it will place on it and be able to have some input before it's put in. So we definitely encourage the passage of HB 130. Thank you.
Thank you. And then finally, Alpheus Bullard with a Legislative Legal. Alpheus is online to answer questions if there are questions from the committee. No. Okay, thank you. Rob, would you like to come back up? Thank you. Thank you, Rob. Representative Cisna? I'm sorry, Representative Gardner. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have just a quick question, Rob. I believe that last year when this proposal came through, or rather evolved to this proposal, there was a letter of support from the municipality of Anchorage. Do I remember that correctly?
Through the chair, yes.
Thank you. That's all I needed to know.
Additional questions? Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are there any estimates as to, on a percentage basis or a dollar basis, how much a sprinkler system might add to, say, an average-sized home? Is there anything out there like that?
Through the chair, Representative Foster. Yeah, there's various estimates. One I've heard is $3 to $5 per square foot.
A 1,500 square foot home, you're looking about $4,500 maybe. So, okay, thank you. Okay,
thank you. Additional questions? Okay. Thank you, Rob. Thank you. Can we have a motion to bring the bill before us, please, for action?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, before us is HB 130. Typically, I like to hold on to a bill and move it at the next meeting to allow additional public testimony. This is a bit unusual since we worked extensively on this issue last year, and all of the parties that were involved are represented here today. So it's really up to the committee. Do you want to take action today, or do you want to move it on Thursday? Representative Gardner.
For myself, Madam Chair, I'm perfectly comfortable with kind of deviating a little bit from the policy and moving this bill forward today.
Okay. Is that fine with the committee?
Absolutely.
Okay. Can I have a motion then to move the bill with individual recommendations and fiscal note?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, and thank you to everybody that showed up today to testify. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. And if we could just take a few minutes to sign the report before we leave, and then I think we're adjourned at that point. So thank you very much. It was a very good meeting today. Thank you. We are adjourned.